The following program
more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm always lost to what to say here at
this point. I think we said our names. We can go home.
Yeah, The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the SEC, which the SEC neither approves nor disapproves of or anything else. It's just that's who the regulator is. It's located in Salado, Texas, and the two guys who are going to be talking on this radio program also happen to be the two principal advisors at the Personal Wealth Coach in Salado. So that's our disclosure. the stuff that we're talking about, we have obtained from sources we believe to be reliable and have kind of carefully vetted it out. I mean, things like the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the places like that, and the Bureau of Economic Analysis. We love bureaus.
Occasionally we read from the app or Reuters. Oh, I mean AP or Reuters, things like that. We occasionally read mainstream news publications, but generally after we've looked at them a little bit deeper.
Yes.
Because there's nothing like having someone who's never studied economics trying to give an opinion on economics. It's generally an opinion.
That's right. And let's see. The information we provide on this radio program should not be considered to be investment advice, because it's not. It's educational information. And if you want investment advice, you need to get it on an individualized basis, because it's the only way it's valid.
One more thing is that our opinions are not those of the radio station or Town Square Media, though they really should be their opinions. I mean, we think they're very good opinions, so our opinions are not their opinions.
That's
for
cool.
Some reason.
Let's see, what happened this week? Well, an interesting thing happened on the way to the market.
All right, what happened on the way to the market?
Well, the S&P 500 stock index, the one we follow most closely, is up 3.54% for the week. Year to date, it's only up 4.22, so almost all of it occurred in this week. It looks really good for 52 weeks, 1 year of 17.45. So what happened? A couple of things big happened to cause that. But before we go there, let's talk about some of the other numbers. Gold and the dollar didn't do much this week. Interestingly enough, if you follow the price of gold, and I know some people do, you'll notice that gold moves inversely to the dollar, and it moves pretty much the same amount. The reason is because most gold is actually traded outside of the United States. India and China dominate the trade in gold. And as the dollar rises, which it hadn't done in some time, if the dollar were to rise against this basket of international currencies, the Wall Street Journal has an index, the price of gold will fall. If the dollar falls, the price of gold will rise, simply because it's priced no longer being priced in dollars as it once was. The primary pricing for gold is out of India and China.
Rupees.
Yeah, rupees and yuan or renminbi. Let's see, treasuries. The benchmark interest rates for all other interest rates, pretty much.
Well, all the other interest rates in the United States, sometimes. I mean, the LIBOR is not here, and that's a kind of a big
but
benchmark.
But that's a short term. The longer term benchmark, the one that the federal government uses and mortgage companies commonly use as a benchmark, is the 10-year U.S. Treasury note. And it got up to 2.94%, dropped back into 2.89% by the end of the week. But it's closing up on 3%. And despite all the other things that are going on out there, it has slowly been climbing. It continues to climb. About a year and a half ago, it was at just over 1%. It's not quite tripled from its bottom, but it was stabilized in the between 1 and 1.5% for quite a while, and it's roughly doubled since in the last couple of years. And there's a pretty good consensus that 3%, maybe 3.5%, is where it's going in the near future. So that probably may influence some of the plans you make. The mortgage interest rates have already climbed up above their historic lows. And there's a meaning to that. It means that the market is anticipating inflation. It means that there's a lot more borrowing pressure. Borrowing pressure historically means a faster economy is coming. In this particular case, though, a lot of the borrowing pressure, a lot of the borrowing demand is coming from the United States government because of the rather extreme deficit we expect to run this year. This year, the federal government is estimating, and economists are estimating, that our deficit will be around $1 trillion, which is pretty astonishing, all things considered. But that's what the tax bill was all about. Ha.
All right.
And I was going to talk about something in the middle of that.
Can I throw something in here? Because this is sort of unrelated to the data, but also extremely, extremely related to the data. A guy named Tim Harford, he's an economist in Great Britain, writes here and there. He wrote on a little postcard, he calls it a critical statistics education that fits on a postcard. And it's not really a statistics education. It's really about fact-checking the stuff that you believe. And he wrote this postcard. It's to the FT readers, FT being Financial Times. Mm-hmm. Financial Times has got some really good articles.
It does.
And right in the middle of those really good articles are some pure hogwash from the original meaning of this was muddy poopy water washed off of a hog. Pure hogwash. The whole concept behind it is a little absurd, and to have them both come from the same organization. So he's got a thing to help people. If you're listening to this program, you already want to know what news is right and what news is wrong. What is fake news? And so here's his step-by-step. It's a six-step quick thing. You can look this up. Just look for Tim Harford postcard. But number one, if you read a headline or a story, number one, observe your feelings. Yeah, so cross your eyes, look inside your head. No, check your feelings. Are you responding to an emotion that you held strongly already? If you're already holding the emotion and it's a strong emotion, all it takes is for them to touch on it, and you have what's called confirmation bias. Anything that's said that's in concert with an existing emotion of yours must be right. Okay, number two, understand the claim. What does it mean? What is this a causal relationship, or is this just coincidence? And what's being left out? That's the other thing. I know this is a lot to go through when reading the news, but if you don't, you're going to get stuck. I mean, it's important. So number three, get the backstory. What was the reason for this story? Number four, put things in perspective. Is it a big number or is it a little number? If we're talking about a plant that lost jobs, well, how many jobs? Or a plant that's hiring, how many? And what is that in the big perspective? Why is it national news? What's the historical trend? Is this really a tax law change, or is this something that was planned decades ago? Beware of statistical significance. That's a big one. When you get an uptick in something, but it's not statistically significant, it's just a little blip, you can turn that into something big, and that's what the job is of the journalist, to make big news. Number five, embrace imprecision. Know that the data is going to be a bit wrong, and take it with a grain of salt. There's no data that's absolutely correct unless it's very old, and even then, not so much. Number six, be curious. Go another click. Treat surprises as a mystery to solve. Dig into it and figure it out.
We had one of those this week.
Well, I wanted to throw this in. There's a good headline to throw this in, and you hold on to your one this week. Pharma bro Shkreli sentenced to 7 years in jail. Although often even Wall Street Journal, weeping pharma bro sentenced to 7 years in jail. Okay, first off, observe your emotions. We all do not like this guy. That's pretty obvious.
Well, you might want to say who he is.
Shkreli is the guy that defrauded two sets of hedge fund investors, bought a pharmaceutical company, and then jacked the prices up by thousands of percent on an antifungal medication that is a life-saving drug for people with immunosuppressant conditions, AIDS, pregnancy, lots of other areas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And made a lot of money doing that and was able to pay back the hedge fund people that he defrauded with his gains from the pharmaceutical company. He still defrauded people, and he's going to prison. Well, this is a case of how big is this on the big scheme of things?
It's kind of good because he seemed to be invulnerable for a while.
Well, yeah, it means that the legal system's working.
Yeah.
He seemed invulnerable just because he was ignoring the legal system as it was working. Well, this is a case of Schadenfreude, if I've ever seen it. That's the pleasure from someone else's misfortune. We want him to have misfortune because he's such a bad mm-hmm. guy, and he's kind of built that image for himself. But keeping in mind that this being front page news as a significant factor, why is it national news when the hedge funds that he defrauded were relatively small, and there have been a lot bigger hedge fund defraud cases that have happened before and after that are still going on that do not make national news? Be aware that the news is there to tap into your existing emotions, that they're going to sell more newspapers, more clicks, more advertisements, because we want to read about his fall. So you've got another one that happened this week. You go ahead.
This is a data point that is very precise
mm-hmm.
and very accurate. And you can research it all you want to, and it still works out to be the same, which I like. But it did happen a long time ago.
What's that?
9 years ago on the 9th, which was yesterday, March 9th, 9 years ago, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index closed at its bottom point, having hit 666 during the day, which is a very significant right. number for some Christians. And it closed out the day at 676. And I think it was 676.54, actually. And, of course, now it's a little higher than that, to say the least.
To say the least, yes.
Yeah, and it's more than tripled since then.
Over 9 years.
But the reason this is significant is this is the ninth birthday of this bull market. We have not had a bear market, which is a decline of 20% or more, in 9 years, which is a long time. And we typically go a lot shorter period of time between bear markets. Does that mean we got another one coming in the near future? No, actually, we haven't broken the record. This is the second longest one in the 20th century. The longest one began in 1987, if you can believe that. So the more severe the panic of 1987 was a real panic. It didn't hit the economy that hard. But it was really scary, and it was really a big fall in the market. It happened very suddenly, and there was a lot of fear. Those of you who remember or were investing back in 1987 remember the tremendous amount of fear. the more severe, sudden, and newsworthy the market collapse is, generally speaking, the longer the bull market that follows it.
Right. And there's good reasons for that. This is all psychologically based. If you had a big burn, you're a little reluctant to jump in and lose all fear. And bull markets die when all the fear is gone. So we're coming out of the Great Recession. And hopefully, I hope there's still some fear out there. Once we see the fear all disappear, that's when we start the time to say, when's the crash coming? So
speaking of which,
so what did that have to do with the statistics? Is just that?
Well, I just mentioned that you were talking about data points. This is right. One of those data points. It's a big. I think it is not much paid attention to.
It isn't.
But it is significant.
Rather have a headline about Scarelli because it's going to sell.
And you know, one of the things that they're popping up now is the comment says the market's too high. We've been gone too long without a downturn in the market. Again, what we do is follow through and say, okay, there's one indicator, which isn't necessarily a very good indicator because the length of bull markets varies from 1.5 years out to about 12 years historically. So we're at 9 years. Okay. Is there any other indicators that a recession is coming? And the answer is nope. Which means that bear markets and recessions tend to go together, although we do have bear markets from time to time without recessions, but we recover from them very quickly. So it's just one of those. The other thing that happened this week that I think was big, it's worth some serious talking about, is the jobs report.
Yeah.
And
looking at that right now.
Officially, 313,000 new hires occurred in the non-farm sector seasonally adjusted.
We would even dispute that and did in the newsletter that more jobs were created than what was reported.
Well, this is the point, and a lot of people don't understand the difference because on the other side is the household survey, which said the unemployment rate stayed at 4.1%.
But also
and
said
795,000 more people went to work.
So think of that for a moment. That's 800,000 mm-hmm. new people with jobs when we added 313,000 jobs. So the reality is that some jobs disappeared in the middle of that.
But
we still netted out way, way more jobs.
Actually, what happens is if you look at the two surveys, and a lot of people have asked me over the years about this. If you look at the two surveys, one is seasonally adjusted, the other one isn't.
Right.
The big one. The big one counts self-employed people as being employed.
Yeah.
The job survey, as you go to employers across a representative sampling of employers across the country in the job survey and say, how many people did you hire?
Well, another source that we like a lot is ADP, which is the biggest mm-hmm. private payroll provider in the country. And they come out with these numbers. But something that they never measure, two people in this room never get measured. We're not on a payroll.
That's right.
We're self-employed.
So if a person, if when they call up the household, and they have households they survey across the country once, and by the way, this is not during the whole month of February. They measured in the same week of the month, each month, the third week, and they go in and they do a lot of calling, and they talk to a lot of people, and they say, how many people are employed in your household? That's why it's called household survey. And how many people are looking for work and how many people aren't, how many adults who could work are not working. And so they get this feel. But this is the interesting thing. The unemployment rate did not jump or fall. The reason is that's a different, when they called the households and they said, okay, now there's 795,000 more people working in the United States than there were last month. The month before when they called households, the same people who had started work in February, back in January, were not looking for work.
Right.
So they never passed through the unemployed sector. They went straight from we're not interested in working to working, which indicates that there is a reserve pool of workers sitting out there that's invisible, that we can't see a shadow, a dark pool of work. We don't know how deep the pool is,
we can,
so we don't know.
We can get a pretty good idea. Because I mentioned this a couple of weeks back on the air when we were looking at the Department of Labor statistics and the Census Bureau statistics of people between the ages of 25 and 54. And the male population that were employed. And it's a lower percentage than in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So it's about 80%, somewhere in that vicinity. Where in the 1960s, it was up in the upper 90s. That because that was the thing. All the men worked back then, and the women did too. They just weren't on a payroll. They worked at home. So coming forward, now a lot more women are working. We've got a lot more people in the economy, but a lot more as a percentage of the women working, and a lot more and fewer as a percentage of the men. We can look at that and say, if a job opportunity comes along with a high enough salary, that's going to suck more people out of those, out of that age group and back in. And another one is, this is very close to us, retirees that are done and happily done get a good offer.
And they get bored. And they go back to work.
They get bored and they get a really good offer and they mm-hmm. say, and a lot, this is a very common refrain. I hear this quite often. Why am I doing this? I wanted to do this. Why did I want to do this? I want to do this. I'm going to stick to it.
Yeah.
And these are people that are already financially independent, but bored.
You were talking about back in 2007, for example, we had about 67% of the working age population in the labor pool.
Right.
Now we got about 63. It means that 5% of the working age population in the United States
left the labor pool.
Left the pool.
And some of that is retirees.
But because our cameras are all underwater cameras, we can't see them because they're out of the pool.
Right.
And so we don't, this is one of the great debates that's going on. How much of this is the opioid addiction epidemic? How much of it is
early retirees?
Well, there's a significant issue,
baby boomers.
If a person's been in prison.
Right.
Or if they've even had an arrest, because there's more and more jobs where merely being arrested at some point in the past effectively prohibits you from working. And so you've got this and several people at the White House became unemployed recently.
For hints of something that could have gotten them arrested.
So one of the big unknowns at this point, and it's something the Federal Reserve has to deal with, is how many people are really unemployed but are saying they're not unemployed, but will suddenly become employed. And there's a reason, because supply and demand comes into effect.
Right. Are going up.
Wages are going up slowly, though. 2.6% over last year, which is close enough to the inflation rate that it isn't a significant issue.
Except in certain places.
Right.
And that's the thing. This is when we're looking at these big averages, when we look at Austin or San Francisco or Manhattan, we don't have wages going up at 2.6%. They're going up at 15 or 20%.
But the cost of living is going up at the
same
rate.
That's correct. So they're going up at the speed of inflation, but inflation is different in different places. And if you're living in Oklahoma and you get a job offer from San Francisco, man, that job offer looks good.
Until
you show up and have to buy a house.
Yeah, or rent, or even rent an apartment.
Right.
The question is, how fast should the Fed raise interest rates? Why do they need to raise interest rates? Because we are approaching economic constraints in the United States. We are approaching the point where, for example, there was a clothing manufacturer clothing manufacturer decided to open up in South Carolina and employ all those unemployed people and make clothing in the United States. And they had machines and computers, and they concluded that they could make clothing in the United States as cheaply as it's made in China or India. And they could bring this back to the United States and employ people, and it would be really, really good. Well, the problem is they could make a lot of money. Giant is the name of the corporation. American Giant is the name of the company. And they really could make a huge profit. They just can't find enough people to work.
This is where automation comes in.
Well, they are automated.
We're getting to the point where automation is going to become more than it means today.
Well, that was their secret.
Total.
That was their secret. They don't have people sitting at sewing machines. They have people operating computerized equipment sent from a central location, and they were going to employ quite a few people. but they literally can't find enough people to operate their computers in an area where they had thought there was a fairly high unemployment rate, South Carolina, and they could gather a lot of people. But the point is they can't get them. And one of the reasons, of course, I hate, you know, it's one of those things, they cannot afford to have people come in there with drugs in their blood.
Right.
And
you can't operate heavy machinery like that with drugs in your blood.
So what we've got is this unknown going on in the country right now. And this unknown is that we are bumping up against restraints, and the principal restraint that historically has caused inflation to spike is the workforce. And once we start running out of workers, then companies will start raising wages and go into competition for the workers. And when you're paying people, and conceivably you wages can double in a bidding war. And if that happens, that's how the big inflation of the 1970s got cranking.
This is why the Federal Reserve
wages went up.
Right. Federal Reserve's looking at all these new hires at a point when we're very near the point where the only reason why more people are coming into the labor pool is because of the higher wages and because people are so desperate to hire people.
Well, this is an interesting point. To take it off to the side, the wages haven't gone up that much. And one of the big question marks that several economists raised this week when they saw that big number come in is, why did these people go back to work? I mean, they looked at the wages of these new hires are getting. They're not getting a significantly higher wage than they would have gotten 6 months ago.
No.
But 6 months ago, the job was open.
Here's the deal. It's been out there. This is one of those things, and you'll recognize it because it follows this concept of the universe is lumpy. Traffic doesn't happen with lots of single cars slowing down individually. It happens in lumps. And we've just hit one of the employment lumps where enough information has been out there for enough time about jobs being available that people that have 6 months ago weren't aware of it, they're not actively looking. And this is the big thing that we're just saying. They're out of the pool. They're not even looking at the labor market. But the news is out there enough now. 6 months ago, the wages aren't that much higher than they were 6 months ago. But a lot of these people stopped working 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And as a comparison to what they were making 5 years ago, it's a big change. And they all became aware of it roughly at the same time because it's making headlines now. It wasn't making headlines 6 months ago. So this is the behavioral aspect of the economy, to say the news has finally saturated the public enough that people that were not even looking, not interested at all in a job, looked up all of a sudden, all together, and said, "Hey, I'm going to go back to work." And the amazing thing is that there are enough jobs out there that we're still requiring more jobs to fill them. We haven't filled all the jobs yet, even with this 800,000 more people jumping into the workforce.
And that's another factor that's worth noting. The big job gains in this employment report were retail trade, 50,000, professional and business services, 50,000. And we got a caller on 773-1400.
You want to finish those statistics real quick, and then okay, we'll get to the caller?
And manufacturing added 31,000 jobs. And I want to come back to the manufacturing added 31,000 jobs.
That's
in February.
That's a big deal.
Because not just that they added the jobs, it's how many more jobs they wish they could have added because they couldn't find anybody to work.
Right.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, you're talking about people who chose not to work for the past 5-10 years or however much, and then they're coming back. I wonder how many of those people are coming back to work because their health care cost is so much higher now than they anticipated that it was 2, 5, or 10 years ago.
That's a good question.
Good question, and I have no official statistical information on that.
What we can say is that the health care prices have been going up, and a lot of the people This is stuff this month we're going to be gathering a lot more data into the future on what happened in February, because we need to look at data on health care cost rising? What was the age of the majority? What's the median age of the people that came back to work in the last month? If we've got a higher group, a higher age group of people, then it may be exactly what you're saying there. It may be healthcare right. costs are up. If it's a younger group of people, it's probably not that. This is when we say economics is a dreary science. It's because by the time you have a dismal science, by the time you have enough information for a really juicy headline, it's 3 months or 3 years after the fact.
Yeah, and anecdotally, I can tell you from talking to our clients and just talking to people in general, I think there's something to what you just said. And the question would be, which somebody needs, well, hopefully somebody will pay enough money to do a survey to figure this out, call around the country and find people who recently returned to work and said, why did you return to work? I can't find any evidence that anybody did that. This report came out late this week. It was a real shocker. The consensus among the people who forecast such things is we're going to have maybe 200,000 jobs added. We had 313. Nobody that I can find said that we were likely to have 800,000 people enter the workforce in February. That was a real shock to every observer and every surveyor. And now there'll be a scramble to figure out what was happening. And above all, the Federal Reserve needs to have a feel for how deep this dark pool is of people who will reenter the workforce. Because if we just exhausted the bottom of the pool with this 800,000 surge, then wages are going to start up, and they're going to start up fairly quickly, and that means the Federal Reserve needs to be raising interest rates to head off inflation. If that dark pool is much deeper, if it is indeed 5% of the economy, because this was just a 5% of the population, because this was just a tiny sliver, this was half a percent at most of the workforce. If this pool is actually much deeper than we thought it was, and there's a lot of people out there who are going to go to work, then the Federal Reserve doesn't need to raise interest rates very fast. So it's a complicated thing, and I'm glad it's not my job to make that decision. Chairman Powell is going to have a good time trying to figure out how to handle this.
I have an idea.
What's that?
Well, there are skilled technical people who are like Indians, like India, and other countries, and we could always increase our quotas on those H-1B visas or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. We're skilled people
well,
to come work.
That is generally an option, but not in this political environment.
No. And the other thing is, for instance, anecdotally, the employment survey, talking to employers, the government's mentioned it. A number of private studies have recently shown it to be a fact. Out in West Texas, one of the reasons the price of oil has been creeping upward is because the fracking operation in West Texas cannot find enough workers to go into the go into the oil fields and do support work and drill holes. And these are relatively unskilled people. These are people who, for instance, drive trucks. One of the big, oddly enough, one of the constrictors right now that's keeping us from drilling more oil wells is sand. And what happens is you have a lot of effectively self-employed people who drive big trucks down to the coast, pick up sand, drive them back to West Texas, and unload the sand. And they have more trucks than they have people to drive them right now. And it's good pay. It does mean that you're gone for a week at a time, and then you come home for several days, and then you're gone for a week at a time. But they're willing to pay some pretty good wages for that. I actually met a guy who does that. But they can't find enough people to do it. They can't, and these are relatively low-skilled jobs. And housing construction we're running short on houses across the country. And one of the reasons the people who build houses are saying is they can't find enough people to drive nails.
Yeah, and enough place. Basically, that's the biggest thing is that the you got to get electricians and plumbers and framers out there. It requires a lot fewer framers than it used to, but you still need the same number of electricians and the same number of plumbers
and
as you always have.
If there's an infrastructure plan, there have been lots of discussion about the fact, if there's an infrastructure plan, they went to the companies that would do the contracting work to build new highways and new bridges and so on, and they said, we can't find enough people to do the projects we have right now. We can't find enough manual labor.
we got a whole lot of young, able-bodied people in these inner cities. They're all tattooed up with their britches hanging down underneath their buns that could just kind of be encouraged or led, motivated.
Let me address that real quick, because you're right if we were talking 6 years ago.
Yeah, but not true anymore.
What's happened in the inner cities, and they've got different names for it now, but the most common name for it is gentrification. There is a, I like to think of it as the nation breathing over a generational cycle. The flow of people into the city and then out of the city. And throughout my life, what you just said was absolutely correct, but it's not correct now. There's still places in the inner city where it's true, but most places in the inner city are being those projects, those big slums are being completely replaced with high income housing. And the people that were in the slums are going out beyond the suburbs. So what we're seeing is the displacement of the unemployed from the inner city to the rural areas. And you can follow the opioid addiction problems, because it used to be an inner city problem. It's no longer a big inner city problem. It's now an out of the city problem.
One of the things that came out in this employment survey is the unemployment rate among young African Americans has dropped pretty dramatically. But the unemployment rate, there's a sector of rural Caucasians, which is effectively the new inner city. They live in the they live in rural areas. They are often unemployed or doing odd jobs, and they cannot seem to – we can't seem to get them employed.
And this is – what you just said is the question that we rose – earlier that we brought up is this concept of how much of our unemployment has to do with drug addiction. How much of the people that are out of the work pool are out of the work pool because nobody can hire them because they won't be able to do their job properly.
There's a very large portion of, and it really don't have good solid evidence on it, but we have enough anecdotal evidence and a few surveys. There's a pretty good sized chunk of Caucasian rural America in the working age population who became addicted to opioids through prescriptions.
Right. This isn't people that were out buying drugs on the street, though they may be doing that now.
And they're largely unemployable because you got to pass a drug test to get any kind of a reasonable job. And that's it's kind of funny. The characteristics that throughout most of my life we associated with inner city African Americans have shifted very nicely, statistically, if you like that, to rural Caucasians. And we maintain these mental images because we occasionally see people
who
fit
grew up with. Yeah, it's what we grew up with.
But it is the shift. But here's the problem, and this keeps coming up. There were some really serious efforts targeted at the inner city for remedial education and drug treatment. And they worked.
Followed by a lot of money going in, because a lot of the inner city was actually owned by the people we're talking about, whether that was African American. Generally, minority, low-income people have been paid a lot of money to move out of their house, enough money that they can go and buy a very nice house outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fascinating thing. If you look at Round Rock, Pflugerville, Georgetown, you'll see that there's an influx of relatively well-to-do minorities. And this is not the first time this has happened in history. This is such a normal part of the pattern. When we have a population influx from a given area of the world, whether that's China or Ireland or Poland or, you think of West Side Story, they tend to settle in a very insular group, Chinatown, or Little Italy, and the headlines of the time is these people are not integrating. What are they here for? They're going to destroy our culture. By the following generation, and then absolutely by the second generation, you may have a little Italy, but it's not where a bunch of people speak Italian. You may have a little Chinatown, but it's just populated with the newest immigrants. It's not.
And
it's a tourist attraction. What we have is the Civil Rights Act took place in the 60s. And if you play the Civil Rights Act as the immigration wave,
what you'll see is this new minority population, it's had to climb an uphill battle, but every immigrant population, our last name is McClure, and there was our family came across as indentured servants. For a long time, there were signs in the bathrooms and when they had bathrooms up to that point, and in the bars and in the public facilities, no mix served. So we do this repeatedly. We're doing it now with the Hispanic population, but you can look at the prison populations. And if you look back at the turn of the 20th century, the majority of the prison population was Irish by about 80%. And if you look in the 80s, the majority of the prison population was African American. And now we have seen the new immigration wave take over. Now the majority of the prison population is Hispanic. So this is a normal thing. This is something that we have done throughout our history.
Let me throw one other thing in here. One of the reasons that, very frankly, that President Trump got elected, one of the reasons that you're seeing what's called a populist revolt right now in the United States is for a very good reason. And I have people that I talk to who are in the middle of this. There are extensive federal programs to help disadvantaged inner city residents, particularly minorities. There are almost no programs to help people in rural areas with identical problems who are mostly Caucasian. And we developed these programs because of the reaction of realizing that we had left behind an entire segment of our population.
And we're doing it again in a different area.
You know, in the 1960s, we realized we've left behind a chunk of our population. And by the 1970s, they were burning cities down, and we said, we got to fix this. So we did a pretty good job of fixing it, or at least we're on the way to fixing it. But
we're ignoring another problem, which is growing bigger and bigger.
We're going to have to get some programs into the rural areas.
And it's not all federal programs. It should be things like, how do we raise the education level? How do we raise the education quality? How do we teach people to innovate? How do we keep them wanting to work rather than needing to work? And that's just about work ethic. It's a lot more than just statistics.
This is the kind of stuff we study all the time, but we got to do some commercials.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake
McClure.
It's a little hard when I do the prompting, but, you know, maybe I should say my name first. Is that?
It's perfectly all right with me.
It's very difficult for us to say our names sometimes. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400.
Yes. What were you going to say?
We have about 10 minutes left in this first hour, and then we have a second hour coming up, and then there'll be a third hour, but we won't be on the air.
I wanted to kind of wrap up what was going on with that last caller. There's a demographic shift that's just happened. When I talk about America breathing, we have a generational shift where everybody runs to the cities, and the city prices for real estate go through the stratosphere. Followed a generation later with everyone running back out to the suburbs and leaving a wasteland of the inner cities. This has happened throughout our history. It's a long cycle, so people don't generally get to see two forms of it. But if you talk to people in their 80s today, what you'll have them tell you about is the big rush into the cities after World War II. This big rush. That's where the jobs were. You could get into the city, you could make things, industrial facilities were being built, and they were manufacturing big cars and many other things, followed by, over a longer period of time, the prices got too high, so new jobs went more towards the service sector, which was not in the inner city. They moved out into the suburb area. And then the people chased those jobs out to the suburbs and left the inner city unemployed and filled up with crime and drug use, and then followed again now with the big jobs or tech jobs, and they're going into the city and they're completely revitalizing this inner city, and they're bulldozing these trash homes, which were not trash homes when they were built originally for that first group that was coming into the city, but they haven't been upkept because the people that have been living in them most recently are unemployed and have been for a long time. So we're seeing the cycle continue. We're going to say something.
Yeah, this employment, Jake was talking about history, and it's important to recognize, again, locally you can do this. You can drive to some of the small towns. Holland is an example.
Yeah, yeah.
Taylor, Bartlett, just east of here, and just drive around in town and look at the ruined houses, the houses that are in decay that obviously nobody's lived there in a long time. The house is probably not fit to live in, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Drive 20 minutes and east of I-35, almost anywhere.
Any town.
And you're going to find any towns out there are decaying, and that there's lots of abandoned houses in farmyards.
Unless you get down near Austin where they're gentrified.
Right. Now they're getting gentrified in their mansions.
But the point I wanted to make is that rural poverty is not something that's in our mind because it really hit like a ton of bricks in the 1920s. And here we are 100 years later, and we're used to urban poverty, and we still focus on urban poverty. You know, there's a few places where time has at least partially stood still. I think Chicago still has some massive urban poverty.
They used to say that about Detroit, but they had a tsunami of poverty that just basically literally decimated the city. There's
right.
more than decimated. It's at one-tenth the population.
There are pockets like Flint, Michigan. There's places that were highly industrialized, where a lot of people came in and stayed there and now can't find jobs. And they moved them into the housing projects, which was a disaster. And so the end result of all of that is you still have these pockets. They still make the headlines. But as an example, as when I was just starting to drive or a little before that, and we lived in Arlington, Texas, and I remember downtown Fort Worth was an area you absolutely stayed out of. It was slums and poor people and drug dealing,
and now it is
amazing. Upscale. It's an upscale, high,
very expensive property.
Right. And this is being going on. This is going on across the country.
Think Harlem or Brooklyn.
Oh yeah,
these are places that throughout my lifetime we've thought of as, well, you don't want to go there. But just a couple of years ago for Christmas, I stayed in Harlem, and there's still crime. It's still a city, but the
crime rate there is actually lower than the national average.
And the place I stayed was an Airbnb, and it was absolutely beautiful, and mm-hmm. it was surrounded by other places that were just as gorgeous.
And we've done the same thing. We've stayed in inner city New York, and I remember very well in the Army one time I was being deployed overseas in the 1970s, and we drove on that interstate that goes over the top of that same section of New York, and it looked like something from a post-apocalyptic movie with cars burned out in the streets and black windows with no glass in them and black stuff coming up from the windows where there'd been fires inside. And it really looked like something out of an apocalyptic movie. Today, those are upscale condos. And so this major change has been going on across the country, and the poverty is right where it was 100 years ago. It's in the rural areas. It's concentrating
in
the rural
out.
Areas.
Shift back out, shift back in. And it is where the population goes. And economics is really only about demographics. Demographics and productivity, that's all it is. And if we can watch the demographic move, the shift of where are the highest employed people living?
And where is the education the least funded?
Right.
And our education system needs to be fixed in the United States. This is one of the biggest things that we face, that we seem to not be willing to accept the challenge.
When was the last time we did a major fix? 100 years ago.
We,
it's pretty amazing.
Right,
this is the time.
Right now, rural schools, particularly well in Texas and across the country, although there's some, the Robin Hood Acts and so on have helped some, Generally,
it also hurt some.
Generally speaking, as you get into the more rural school districts, you get less and less quality education. And in the upscale inner cities, and this may sound really weird to you, the places that used to be the slums and the terrible
right.
places to
this
teach.
This is where the charter schools are forming. These right. are the newest technology, newest science on how to educate, and they're forming in inner cities.
And so what you have is a cycle that perpetuates poverty in the rural areas. We drove across West Texas and up through New Mexico and up into Colorado last year on vacation. And we took the back roads and saw a lot of little towns that were just reminded me tremendously of the inner city of the 1970s. There was graffiti on the walls. Mm-hmm. There's boarded up buildings. There's houses that are falling apart. There's trailers that are falling apart.
The difference is it's easier to catch the people doing the graffiti because there's only three of them.
So there's this major shift going on, and unfortunately, the news media has a tendency to focus in the bigger city areas and focus on the pockets. Jake was talking about how to spot misleading or false news information. It's not necessarily false.
It's just
when they focus in on the poverty of Flint, Michigan, they're focusing in on the poverty of Flint, Michigan because it's concentrated and it fits with your paradigm and it fits with what you think ought to be there. And you say, oh, yeah, there it is. I knew that was there.
Right. That's called confirmation bias. And, but in order to maintain your intelligence with the times, you need to be aware of when your own emotions are giving greater credence than necessary to a headline or to anything else for that matter. I mean, there's a great quote that when the elections were underway and Donald Trump tweeted a statistic on crime rate in the African-American community. It was called on the carpet and Bill O'Reilly and said this statistic is absolutely wrong. And Donald Trump's response was, do you expect me to check every statistic? And the answer that I am asking for to him and to everyone else is yes. There's a lot of false information out there. If the president's the number one claimer of fake news, then the president shouldn't be releasing it as well. So we've got a duty to each other to verify anything that we spread as being true.
And
we're about out of time for this hour.
We're about out of time. We got something I think is very important to talk about next hour. There's a recession predictor that's turned out to be very, very accurate, and I want to talk about that. And you probably got some things to talk about,
yes,
too.
Yes, I do. If you would like to call us off the air, you can reach us at locally at 947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can email us directly at Jake@tpwc.com or Jeff@tpwc.com. And we'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.